Okay, folks. So, I've just handed out to everybody another two sheets here. So I wanted to read to you something from off here first. This is part of a letter that Frank, this is from God's Fool also, part of a letter on page 258 that Webb wrote when he was about to go into Ward 2 hospital. He writes, "So please let me go back to Ward 2. During the first week I spent there, I was entranced by a new vision of man, unindoctrinated, denied me for so many years." Now this is about 10, 15 years after he wrote the leper poem. He's been in mental hospital, he's come back to Australia, he's been locked into Parramatta Psych Hospital.
Parramatta.
"Entranced by a new vision of man, unindoctrinated, denied me for so many years. To keep this vision alive and burning is my duty and my joy. In the central and abysmal deeps of my paranoiac, or what have you, mind, I had dared to dream that later I might be a nurse among these patients. God spare all our days. Anyway, my request for another ward was occasioned by that blind obsessive fixation or complex to write poetry. Poetry requiring any intellectual scale is, I grant you, impossible in Ward 2, and this is a cruel snuffing out of my little dream. But there at least I can strive to scribble out the odd, slight and truncated piece." In March of this year, 1961, Webb began sending some of these odd and truncated pieces to Douglas Stewart at the Bulletin. Webb referred to them as turgid, involved, but a genuine taste of immediate environment, perhaps. The first of these, Pneumoencephalograph, up there on the screen, is some of the key poems in Ward 2, like others of his work, like The Canticle, like Air All Alone, Webb used to like creating these sequences of poems. If it was sequences about Edward John Eyre or Ludwig Leichhardt, here it's sequences about people in Ward 2. And on the left-hand side there is a photograph of the walls outside Ward 2. At the bottom is the stone clock in Parramatta Psych Hospital, which was stuck at 3 o'clock. And there are two images there from Peter's work that you can see behind. We'll come to those in a moment. At the heart of this sequence, there is the stone wall of the psychiatric hospital. Now that's why I wanted to do the leper, to kind of give you the background here, which stands as a symbol for man's fundamental indifference to the fate of his fellow man. And here's one stanza from the poem The Man, which we might look briefly at in a moment. "The clock in its tower of worked Baroque stone holds at 3 o'clock and has always done. Nothing else shuffles, works, is ended, begun. There is only the solid air, the solid wall. Away down the roots, away down, who said let there be light?" Webb's intention is to break down this wall for himself, for us, through his empathy with each of the characters that make up this sequence. His purpose is embodied in those lines from Paul's exhortation to the Ephesians, which are concerned with man's reconciliation with himself and with others, a reconciliation symbolized in the image of Christ on the cross. From Ephesians, "You who once were far off have been brought near in the blood of Christ. For he is our peace, who has made us both one and has broken down the dividing wall of hostility by abolishing in his flesh the law of commandments and ordinances, that he might create in himself one new man in place of the two, so making peace." And then I add, like Paul's, Webb's Christianity, emerging out of his own experience as an outsider, is a radical challenge to conventional Christianity, which often supports society's tendency to ostracize those who infringe the norms of the day. When it acts in this way, conventional Christianity perpetuates the Old Testament practice of expelling evil from the community through the agents of the scapegoat or through putting them behind walls. I don't know if you'll all agree with that. That's certainly the way I saw it 20 years ago. Let's go to the poem, which is on page 21. So this poem, which occurs, a man, which occurs right in the middle of the sequence, page 21, is more a generic description of one of the patients in Ward 2. Almost a mythic picture of man imprisoned. And this refrain, away down the roots, away down, who said, let there be light, could be seen as a reference to the sense of complete isolation and the sense of hopelessness of this individual. It begins, he can hardly walk these days, buckling at the knees, wrestling with consonants, in raggedy car keys, faded from ancient solar festivities. He loiters, shuffles, fingering solid wall. Away down the roots, away down, who said, let there be light? The clock in its tower of worked Baroque stone holds at 3 o'clock and has always done. Nothing else shuffles, works, is ended, begun. There is only the solid air, the solid wall. Away down the roots, away down, who said, let there be light? 3 weeks under the indigent paid-off clock, he pulls from his photograph album the heavy chalk, squats like a king behind a heavy lock, niched in and almost part of solid wall. Away down the roots, away down, who said, let there be light? I'm imagining here that Webb is actually looking at somebody within the ward. At one moment, this person who has been separated from all his known environment actually has a photograph album in his hands, is opening it and is beginning to look at aspects of his past. And in that, he sees, skipping down to the last stanza on that page, he's reconnected with aspects of his past life. His king's cup for swimming, the shimmering girl, the photogenic light aircraft spin and whirl out of the loam, stained by all weathers, hurl their petty weight against a solid wall. Away down the roots, away down, who said, let there be light? It's like almost Webb is kind of seeing through this imprisoned figure who's almost entrapped by the wall itself, he's seeing something else emerge. And if we move on to the last stanza, but his cup glitters, the light monoplane bucks into the headwind, girls in panel trucks arrive like flowers, and the dry mouth sucks deeply, puffs into flesh behind solid wall. Away down the roots, away down, who said, let there be light? Something arrives in this last stanza, some element that transfigures or transforms that wall into flesh. It's as if somehow, through writing this poem, there's been a metamorphosis from this entrapped figure into someone who's been able to access something of his humanity again. So there's almost a kind of a rhetorical answer in that last refrain, away down the roots, away down, who said, let there be light? And there is a sense, certainly I see it, that light somehow emerges at the end of this poem.
It's one of the few poems that gives a thumbs up for smoking.
Yep.
That last image of yep. Puffs deeply and you go beyond the wall.
Beautiful. I like it. I like it. Beautiful. Very good.
Let there be light is creation. That's how creation came about. So he's somewhere deep in it, he's found a creative spring.
Beautiful. Somewhere deep in him, he's found a creative spark in that. And I've missed out a couple of important stanzas there, but I'm just very conscious of the time we've got left. So we're moving into Wild Honey. Now, Wild Honey is an atypical poem in the sequence. The very first poem, Pneumoencephalograph, is a poem which shows Webb looking at one of his inmates having to go through this horrific treatment of having a bubble of air blown up his spine so they can investigate his spinal column and his brain. They put up coloured material into there. And Webb is kind of watching this process, watching his response to this process. The other poems in the sequence describe characters like the homosexual, like the old women. Here in this last poem, Webb actually turns the camera onto himself, very much so. And the title is wonderfully metaphoric, because within the poem, he refers to himself and his fellow inmates as drones. He talks about them as groping among the chilly combs of self-contemplation. He sees himself, as spiritually dead and lacking any kind of life. But what happens in this poem is it's sports day. And I remember being a nurse at Parramatta Hospital, and I remember on sports day, selective patients were allowed out of their wards to go onto the big field next to Parramatta Psych Hospital and go and play cricket there. And it was a tremendous sense of occasion when they were let out to be part of a community. And they went out there and played cricket or football, cricket in this instance. So there's this kind of opening. But what happens in this poem is rain comes and everything sags under the rain. The tents that have been set up for sports day, everything sags. Everything turns to nothing. It's a tragic moment, except suddenly out of the corner of his eyes, Frank Webb sees a young girl with golden hair. And something in him is attracted to that girl and to that golden hair that embodies and expresses wild honey. And he's described himself as a drone. Something miraculous takes place as he confronts his own maybe lustful thoughts towards this young woman, tries to digest that and tries to look closely at his own inner workings, and at the end comes out in this beautiful celebration. Now let me read the poem. And when I've read the poem, I'm going to ask Peter, first of all, to describe his series over here with its focus in the middle on wild honey. We'll get Peter to have a exchange on that first of all. So let's read the poem. I might make a few comments along the way. Saboteur autumn has riddled the pampered folds of the sun. You know, autumn, of course, is a saboteur. It comes and interferes with the processes of the summer season. Gum and willow whisper seditious things. Servile leaves now kick and toss in revolution. Wave bunting die in operatic reds and golds. This is autumn. Autumn leaves, of course, life is decaying with autumn. And that's the setting for his own sense of lifelessness. And we, the drones, of course, are stingless, make no honey, got no profit. We the drones, fated for the hundred stings, grope among chilly combs of self-contemplation, while the sun on sufferance from his palanquin offers creation one niggling lukewarm grin. Palanquin is the litter box, litter, the couch that's giving the world one last lukewarm grin. But today is sports day. Not a shadow of doubt. Scampering at the actual frosty feet of winter under shavings of the pensioned blue, we are the spring. True, rain is about. You mark old diggings along the arterial street of the temples, the stuttering eyeball, the residue of days spent nursing some drugged comatose pain, summer, autumn, winter, the single sheet of rain. So he's describing in the second half of that stanza, he's describing his own face his own features, the diggings, the arterial street of the temples, the stuttering eyeball, the residue of days spent nursing some drugged comatose pain. So, you know, there's the sense of spring in the sports day, there's the sense of autumn kind of bearing down on them, but there's also this overwhelming sense of his own mortality and age. Summer, autumn, winter, a single sheet of rain. And the sun is carted off, and a sudden shower. Lines of lightning patrol the temples of the skies. Drum, thunder, silence sing as one this day. Our faces return to the one face of the flower, sodden and harried by diehard, disconsolate flies. Disconsolate, vigorously resisting flies. All seasons are crammed into pockets of the grey. Joy, pain, desire, a moment ago set free, sag in pavilions of the grey finality. So everything is kind of drowned in the rain. All hope seems to be extinguished at this point. Now, what happens in the next part of the poem? Under rain, in atrophy in degeneration, in lack of use, under rain, in atrophy, dare I watch this girl combing her hair before the grey broken mirror, the golden sweetness trickling. Her eyes show awareness of my grey stare beyond the swirl of golden fronds. It is her due. And terror, rain-like, is all involved in this golden glow, playing diminuendo its dwarfish role between self-conscious fingers of the naked soul. So there's some sense here in which he's kind of aware of his own rather malevolent, dangerous presence watching this young girl, aware of her terror perhaps at this psychiatric patient standing looking at her. But there's Webb's sense of the beauty of the golden fronds of her hair, the golden glow of her presence, a rather complicated portrait here of some interaction between this young girl and the speaker. And now in the next stanza, really kind of self-confrontation takes place in the speaker's own conscience. Down with the mind a moment, and let Eden be fullness without the prompted unnatural hunger, without the doomed shapely ersatz thought. See faith as all such essential gestures, unforbidden, persisting through fall and landslip, and see, stranger, the overcoated concierge of death as a toy for her gesture. See her hands like bees store golden combs among certified hollow trees. Have the gates of death scrape open. Shall we meet beyond the platoons of rainfall, a loftier hill hung with such delicate husbandries? Shall ascent be a travelling homeward past the blue frosty feet of winter, past childhood, past the grey snake, the will? Are gestures stars in sacred dishevelment? The tiny, the pitiable, meaningless and rare, as a girl beleaguered by rain and her yellow hair. Now those last three lines, which pick up some of the imagery and associations of 5 days old, the tiny, not the immense, will teach our groping eyes, are gestures. Now this, he's talking about the gesture of this girl combing her hair. Are gestures stars? We've had stars imagery all the way through. Are gestures stars in sacred dishevelment? The tiny, the pitiable, meaningless and rare, as a girl beleaguered by rain and her yellow hair. So Peter, you're on the stage. You're on the stage. Now tell us, from this poem and from the other poems in Ward 2, what led you and when to reproduce this painting? And what were you seeing? What were you trying to convey artistically? Maybe Cheryl and Murray, you come over here. That might be good. Or turn it round. That's where this way. Good.
Hello. Did a brief stint of psych nursing at Ryan Peters Hospital back in 1971. I was only there a short while, working the wards with Frank, the patient. So with the painting, and I did it many, many years later.
What year did you do it? 1978?
96. Down there.
Yep.
So many years in regards to the different poems in walk through. But a lot of the visual references, I remember in the ward, it was a bungalow ward. And there used to be, back to the image of the wall, an elderly, retarded man who used to stand against the wall like he was just frozen. And I used to have the job as a nurse of trying to shift him to go and have lunch.
Yep.
And I remember Frank, he'd walk around, head down most of the time, very back to absorbed skies.
Yep.
He was a very self-absorbed person. And I remember one time Frank was standing there and this other guy and this feeling of I'm trying to get this other guy to get him out of
yep.
the toilet.
Yep.
And it was just
yep.
a world that everybody were all locked
stuck.
In their own.
Yep. Yeah. Yep.
So that's a bit of a reference, but equally with the poetry. But reading the poems, what's so magical about them is, okay, you've got the scene in a public hospital toilet with a basin and people glum and dead, but in the poems, suddenly the wall would become a mountain. And so maybe a memory of mountains out west and Frank one time saying to me, leave this place, go to the country. The country is where things are better. But so the image of the wall, the wild honey sequence in the middle, and yeah, there was a sports oval just down the way at Rydalmere, and they'd have their cricket matches. And I'd see Frank walking out and about by himself, always by himself, sort of essentially alone. And but there are other aspects, and with all the patients that wear those funny sort of Australian sort of hats.
Like yours?
No, more, you know, the cricket hat.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, and if there's a lovely image, you want the or two, gape at your porridge, eat it like a god.
Yeah.
And that sort of delight in just living in a very sort of realist way, that comes into play. So there's sort of a sense of the energy of the different patients. Funny scene one time, I was pouring a big pot of tea for all the patients out in the lawn, the bungalow. And Frank came up and I says, it's hard work, you know, maybe if they had a bigger teapot, we could put all the patients in the teapot. And Frank looked at me and said, you got imagination, we're going to get on. And then with that, he suddenly, there was another patient, like Alfie, who looked a bit like this guy. And he's all re-me-me, and back to somebody asked a question about how Frank got on with the patients. And Frank's trying to talk to me and going, I used to be in the Air Force, and he's got his hands and flying around. And then Alfie started interrupting. And then he said, where do you learn your manners? You know? So he could have a funny exchange with people. He could get quite icky with people. But essentially, he was reclusive most of the time.
Yeah.
But I think with nurses, we had lots of conversations in his room and talked about art and different aspects. So And this first image, that Newman's cephalograph poem, which I read as that's him come to this cabin of art. Him going through an awful sense of having to look into himself. And there's references in the painting to Australian artist Albert Tucker, who did a series of heads that become landscapes in a very stricken, fossilized desert sense. But extreme to that is with the poem Homosexual. There's an image almost like a Blake nude of Glad Day with a young man naked rising. And so that's a celebratory image. A bit of a William Blake sort of approach there.
The old women.
The middle one, there's a Renaissance painter called Giorgione who did a beautiful painting of a woman nursing a baby, and on the other side there's a soldier standing and some lightning. But it's got that whole feeling of wild honeys. It's like the world's appeared, you know, with a backdrop of light. So there's a bit of a reference to that with the autumn theme. The whole thing of the wall, if you're a painter, that's what your life is, facing the wall. I understand the metaphor of the wall from years of just standing in a wall, in a way. But the whole task in painting, and maybe what Webb does so wonderfully in his poems, to open up that world into worlds that go deeper, richer, rather than... If you're a minimalist painter, you just look at a white wall and say, ah, that's enough. But what's so wonderful with Webb's poems, it's not enough. You know, you've got to see infinity.
Beautiful. Thank you, Peter. That's fantastic. So, so we've got 10 minutes left, and I'd like to look at the last two stanzas of Wild Honey. I'd like us to see whether we can empathize and understand what may be a kind of transformation of Webb's own sense of impossibility in the situation that he finds himself in. In the third last stanza, he talks about the girl's awareness of my grey stare and the terror rain-like involved in the golden glow. That stanza seems to depict his own agonized sense of the inappropriateness, maybe, of his gazing at this young girl. And in the last two stanzas, it's as if he somehow dismantles that and looks at himself in a broader, perhaps more objective way, and comes through to transform the situation into one of hope and one of acceptance, and indeed one of transfiguration almost. Let me read the last two stanzas and let's see if we can put our heads together and draw some of the threads out of the language here. Down with the mind a moment, and let Eden be fullness without the prompted unnatural hunger, without the doomed shapely ersatz thought. Ersatz is the German word for substitute. Substitute thought usually means something lacking in substance. See faith as all such essential gestures, unforbidden, persisting through fall and landslip. I presume he's talking about the fall. And see, stranger, the overcoated concierge of death as a toy for her gesture. See her hands like bees store golden combs among certified hollow trees. Have the gates of death scrape open. Shall we meet beyond the platoons of rainfall, a loftier hill, hung with such delicate husbandries? Shall ascent be a travelling homeward, past the blue frosty feet of winter, past childhood, past the grey snake, the will? Are gestures stars in sacred dishevelment, the tiny, the pitiable, meaningless and rare, as a girl beleaguered by rain and her yellow hair? Notice that the last stanza is made up of three long questions, rhetorical questions. Do they need an answer? So let's share some thoughts about what we think maybe Frank Webb is going through as he looks at this situation from a perspective where he's letting the mind be prompted without unnatural hunger.
Getting past the mind. It says...
You're not on.
It says, down with the mind, a moment. So he's getting beyond thought into more intuitive areas.
Okay, good. So he's moving into something more intuitive. Now, what's he moving into then?
Well, and beyond desire, his desire, that sexual desire.
Yeah, I think that's quite possible. Anybody want to speak? You don't want to speak? Just hold it. Good.
Can I make a comment about it?
Yep.
Doom shapely, assess thought.
Yep.
To me, that sums up the whole, there's a dark side of art. It's doomed, or knowledge, it's doomed to fail. That will, at the end of the day, just be a bit of plywood against the wall. The image will never substitute for the reality. And that's a tragic realization. If you invest, which Webb would have, as an intellectual, as a poet, would have invested a huge amount of his life to creating an alternate reality, only to find out it's doomed. It will be washed away in a greater reality, which is life ongoing. If that makes
sense. Yeah, that makes sense. So what is the greater reality that his poem is actually hungering for, trying not necessarily to delineate, but to reach towards? What is the greater reality that he's reaching towards?
Which is the journey to death, in a way.
Well, he says, have the gates of death scrape open. But he then says, or asks at the end, are gestures stars in sacred dishevelment? The tiny, the pitiable, meaningless and rare, as a girl beleaguered by rain and her yellow hair. What is that asking? Are gestures stars? What, yes, please, Mari, over here. Microphone around.
I don't know if it's any help, but I used to do music therapy down at Kew Cottages in Melbourne.
Yep.
And I worked with the absolutely profound, intellectually disabled, physically and mentally.
Yep.
When we played, the more music we played, there was one little person, they were all on mats, they can't stand up. She used to move and stand to the music.
Yep.
And they told me that her mother had been a concert pianist. But these were, every one of them were physically and intellectually profoundly handicapped.
Yeah, yeah.
And when I was looking at this dishevelment thing, sacred dishevelment, are our gestures stars in sacred dishevelment? That, to me, sprang to my mind as an example of that.
Right.
I don't know what, anyone can understand what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
But those people, there's something so beautiful, so innocent about all of those children, or some of them are older. There's something about these people that John Bonnier has grasped
Yes.
totally.
Yes.
And I think the same applies here to Francis Webb and all the people who have struggled with mental illness.
And did you want to add something?
So
you resonated, you felt there was some truth in that as it applies to the poem here. So what is it, Anne, in the poem, the situation that strikes you as having a resemblance to that?
I've
a bit closer to the microphone.
I feel, I'm not sure, I don't think it's right, but I felt this was the gates of death scraping open. It's a vision of heaven. He's grasping for heaven.
And so what constitutes heaven in this situation? Is it his way of seeing in a kind of a manner of detachment? Is he able to separate from his own perhaps lustful sexual thoughts? Is he finding a way of perceiving reality from a new position and seeing the gestures of her combing her hair, the simple act of combing her hair, this honey-coloured hair, as some manifestation of something beyond his own narrow world? Is it a kind of a breakthrough moment? Is it something along those lines?
Yeah, and it relates to 5 days old.
Yep, yep.
It does relate to 5 days old.
Tell us.
Three.
Yep.
Particularly certain stanzas. I didn't know the stanzas, I can't think of them.
Yep.
I'm so overwhelmed. But yes, it was the same thing in 5 days old.
The tiny, not the immense, will teach our groping eyes.
There's just something that these people have is totally is disabled. They have a beauty and a goodness that is just. I could tell you a lot of good stories on this,
but I won't. Yeah. And go, please, yes.
It's something a bit different.
Go, yes.
And a bit of a naive way of call it an oriental wisdom at the end, where the pitiful, the meaningless and rare, it's almost like a Zen vision of a universe you don't have to interpret.
Yeah.
It's sort of has a freedom, whereas a 5 days old is still a devotional sort of respect for the order of the universe. But there's a freedom at the end of Wild Honey that is just oriental.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting thought. Did you want to add something, Mari, over here? You had your hand up before. No?
I was resonating with
Mari. Okay. And Gavin, you want to add something?
Just to add.
A bit louder, please.
It's about heaven or salvation, perhaps. So the line that really strikes me is, shall the scent be a travelling homeward past the blue frosty feet of winter, past childhood, past the grey scent of the world. So that line, the grey scent, was very chilling. And it's sort of like having to overcome the world, I suppose, in order to achieve salvation, perhaps.
Something needs to separate from his own volition and allow something else to enter in his way of seeing the world.
Snake was a symbol of knowledge, so that his knowledge of the world had to be dropped before he could just appreciate the impression.
That's
what I meant about the art. That grand artistry he's going to make.
So in fact, he allows the image of the girl beleaguered by rain and her yellow hair, he allows the simple primacy of that image to really connect with him at a much deeper level. It kind of opens him in a new way, beyond all the earlier struggles with his reactions to that image. Yeah.
It's a move away from the hierarchical great state of the world.
Yeah.
That's what I call it, an oriental
view.
Yeah.
It's
non-hierarchical.
Yeah.
It's like a moment of grace
as well. It is, exactly. It is a moment of grace. It's a moment of prayer as well. You know, really kind of coming through to a different way of relating to the world. past all his own obfuscating elements, aspects.
Transcendence.
Yeah. And with that word of transcendence, it's a nice word on which we will finish, because it is now, you can hear the bell tolling outside. So I've really enjoyed working with you all. It's been a journey for me as much as for you. I've kind of reconnected with Webb. I did my work on him 20 years ago, so it's been wonderful for me to reread, reacquaint, and to see that it's still so much life in the poetry. And you know, obviously it's the beginning of a journey. Please get your Webb and read some more. Maybe we'll have another seminar in a year or so's time, and we can take it deeper and further.
Skunk Owl.
Yes.
Rob Lowell.
Yes.
He gets to absolutely the end of everything with the one tiny little gesture.
That's
of
right.
A little skunk.
That's right.
Gets him going, because he had, of course, severe mental illness.
He did. And do you know that Frank Webb was very keen on Robert Lowell and read him in Canada at the time? Yeah.
Well, they would have a lot in common.
They did have a lot in common, very much so. Thank you all. And if you want to have another seminar with me, there's one happening in November here.
And I would just like to thank you formally from us. It's just wonderful to have you here, and you're welcome anytime to come back.
That's my
pleasure. And I'm looking forward to Rilke.
Yeah, I am too. Yeah, good.
Thank you.